Once upon a time, there were four little rabbits.
How old are you, Johnny? She asked.
16.
We few, we happy few, we band of brothers.
It was the best of times. It was the worst of times.
A wise old king once said, "Of the making of books, there is no end." How true today. Of the overabundance of writing published each year, what's worth reading? The answer is simple. Read only the best. Come join the discussion on Just the Best Literature.
Well, hello again, everyone. Thanks for listening in today. I am truly excited to be back in the studio with you today. Why? Well, today we begin taping our summer and early fall book series titled Blast from the Past. Now, instead of explaining these details, I think it would actually be more fun for you to hear our KPCG.FM promo for the series.
A quarter of the world's population is now living under some form of lockdown due to coronavirus.
No beaches, no swimming pools, no gyms, no sports, no worries. No one can lock down your brain this summer.
Freedom!
You're invited to jump into Just the Best Literature's Blast from the Past. You'll have a classic summer guaranteed. Our summer blast begins with George Orwell's prophetic classic, 1984. It's more current than you think.
Down with Big Brother.
Yes, George wants you to think about and see what's happening in our world. Here's an important secret. There's no thought police in the JBL studio.
All aboard!
Once we've got you thinking, then you'll cruise with Joseph Conrad and Marlowe. Wait, is Conrad Marlowe? This question will be answered as we explore youth, the heart of darkness, and Lord Jim. On this cruise, we'll talk with Conrad, or is it Marlo, through his thought-provoking letters. These ports of call will likely take us into the early fall.
What?
Is your JBL host a skipper or a poet?
Wait, did I just rhyme?
You'll never know unless you come on board JBL's Blast from the Past.
I trust you enjoyed listening to the promo just as much as I did writing it. Now, the voice of KPCG.FM and executive producer Dwight Falk added the catchy extras. Now, this series, I think, is going to be interesting, thought-provoking, and life lesson intensive for not only students, but all adults who love to read. Now remember, the main goal of Just the Best Literature is to inspire listeners to read only the best literature. And by the best literature, I mean the literature that can not only entertain us, but also educate us. Our tribute to Charles Krauthammer series on essays, I think, did that for us in a marvelous way. And I think this summer and early fall series is going to be great too. Now we're going to go back to classic fiction. But I just think I need to say also that Just the Best Literature is very selective in our choice of fictional literature. We do highlight fiction that will teach us lessons and how to live a moral, productive life that will not only benefit the individual, but will also share a relationship with those around us and then eventually move out and affect the very world we live in. So certainly nonfiction, I think, such as history and biography are the best reads. However, even Jesus Christ at times used parables or stories to get his message across to the multitudes that followed him. So I think it is appropriate for JBL to go back and forth between fiction and nonfiction. And, of course, we will get back into some history later on in this year. And maybe I should say into the year 2021. Now, here's why we feel the way we do. The large majority of fiction printed today is really disastrously toxic. It's toxic morally, it's toxic socially. I shudder to think about the fiction that's being produced for the youth of this world. I mean, the thinking behind, you know, what people are writing, it's so full of witchcraft, it's so full of, you know, dystopian themes. It's really not good for the minds of young people. So this is what really motivated me, let's say, to choose the books that we did for this 2020 summer series. For the next several programs, what I want to do is I want to give you some interesting background information on George Orwell. He's the author of 1984. Now, 1984 is the first book that we are going to be discussing in the series. Now, to help me do this, I'll be using quotes from, there is a Great Courses series of lectures titled George Orwell, A Sage for All Seasons. And there's also a book, it's Michael Sheldon's authorized biography of Orwell. Now, Michael Sheldon is also the lecturer for the Great Courses series. And I don't know how many of you out there are familiar with the Great Courses, but they have all kinds of instruction that you can get. And even in this series, I was able to buy it, well, really a couple of weeks ago, and I've already been through half of the lectures in the course. So I think it's that interesting. And they're only like a half hour at a time, so it's really not hard to get through them. Let's look at George Orwell. I do think we need to get some of his background. I'm going to read you a quote from this Great Courses series. And again, the author, or maybe I should say the lecturer, is Michael Sheldon. Here's what he says the purpose of the course is. And again, the course title is George Orwell, A Sage for All Seasons. He goes on to say, the purpose of this course is to understand how George Orwell rose from provincial obscurity to become the most influential British author of the last 100 years. Now, that's really holding true even for today. I mean, even on radio programs I've listened to, even on news programs, so many people are talking about our Orwellian world. I even heard there were some British subjects saying on the news, well, we need Big Brother. We need to have Big Brother right now. And yet, if you look at some of the more conservative news, they're afraid of Big Brother. They're afraid of what's happening in this whole epidemic or pandemic, I guess. We really should call it that. But there are people grabbing for power. And, of course, that's, as we go through the book 1984, you're going to see that's the subject that George Orwell is dealing with. The thing that so many people don't know, maybe more people realize it more than I did when I first ran across 1984, is that George Orwell is really not the author's name. It is a pen name. It's interesting that Orwell chose this name for himself, and even his publisher at first didn't want him to do this, but he did change his name. And so George Orwell is the pen name of Eric Arthur Blair. You know, honestly, I think that actually the name George Orwell is a lot more cool than the name Eric Arthur Blair. That's my opinion. He's dead now, so he can't come after me for saying that. But anyway, I do think it's very interesting. Now, I want to read you just a second quote, and this is actually going to be from Michael Sheldon's biography about the idea of the names. He just says in the very beginning of his biography, here's a note on names. He says, writing this book would have been a little easier if Eric Blair had chosen to write his books under his own name. So here's his authorized biographer, Michael Sheldon, is a little frustrated that Eric Blair chose the name George Orwell. He says, how should a biographer refer to him? Should one call him Blair or Orwell? He was nearly 30 when he decided to make George Orwell his pseudonym, but he never legally adopted it, and his family and oldest friends never stopped using his real name, Eric. I call him by both names. In the early chapters, I try to maintain a sharp distinction between the life of the young person named Eric Blair and the later reflections on that life by the writer known as George Orwell. But at the point in the story when Blair chooses his pseudonym, I close the gap and almost always refer to the man and the writer by one name only, Orwell. So I think, you know, it's really kind of interesting that he actually did, and by many people, in his time period where he lived, they actually knew him as Orwell. They didn't know him as Eric Blair. And I think in some ways he really liked that. And I think there's actually probably a couple of reasons why this happened. I know from reading some of his writings, one reason why he liked the name George Orwell had to do with his father's occupation as an official in the British Empire. He was embarrassed about his job, and we'll talk about this some more in this program. But also, he didn't want to embarrass his family by what he wrote. George Orwell, besides being a great novelist, was also a great political essayist. His political essays actually did point out flaws in the British imperialism, or even in the British Empire, we could say it that way. And some of his novels dealt with subjects that good British subjects just don't talk about. And so it would have been embarrassment to his parents. I think in some ways when they began to read his writings, they approved of the change in names. So anyway, here's what this George Orwell, A Sage for All Seasons, the introduction says some more about him. He says, with uncanny foresight, Orwell warned against so many of the ills plaguing modern life, especially the rise of the surveillance state, the tyranny of groupthink, the clever lies of propaganda, and the political pursuit of power for its own sake. And he goes on to say, this course illuminates how he developed his passionate commitment to the individual freedom as the last defense against the modern tendency to politicize every aspect of life. And if you listen to conservative news, they are always talking about your top newscasters are always talking about how everything right now is getting politicized. And so I think we're just right on target here with getting ready to talk about 1984. But let's talk a little bit more about his family background. I personally believe that if you're ever going to understand what an author writes about, you need to understand about the author. You know, most authors really include things they're familiar with their own lives. And generally, they might change the character, or they change the name, or they change the situation, but they still, are writing from their experience. And I know that even as a writer, I write from my own experience and what I've experienced over the years. And it was just last week I turned 68, so I'm just getting younger all the time. So I'm really, really happy about that. The one thing about Eric Blair, he was one of three children. And in fact, he was a boy sandwiched between two sisters. But let's focus on his father now. I had to practice his name, so I'm going to see if I can really pull this out. But his father was Richard Walmsley Blair. As we go through this, you're going to see that he was a bit of a bore. But anyway, we probably should not pick on him very much yet. But we will. Let me just read some of these quotes. And this is from Michael Sheldon's book called Orwell, or titled, I should say, Orwell, the Authorized Biography. Now, here's what Michael Sheldon writes. He says, Richard Blair was very much a Victorian figure, and the age difference between them accounted to almost a half century. And so he's comparing Richard Blair with his son, Eric Arthur Blair. He goes on to say that Richard Blair was born on January 7th, 1857. George Gissing, I guess it's called, his name, is the Victorian novelist whose work would later become a source of so much fascination for Orwell. And he was born that same year. Now, I don't know anything about George Gissing. I'm assuming that he was a popular novelist at the time. He says, the Crimean War had recently ended. Lord Palmerston was prime minister, and Queen Victoria was preparing to give birth to the last of her nine children. Charles Dickens was writing Little Dorrit, and I do love to read Charles Dickens. Thomas Hardy was still in his teens, and George Bernard Shaw was only 6 months old. Like Shaw, Richard Blair would lead so long a life that it would take him from the dawn of the railway age to the dawn of the nuclear age. There are many men from that time period that lived a long time. And Winston Churchill was born in that same time period. Of course, Herbert Armier Armstrong was also born in that same time period. These men were shaped by that age. So I think we would say very clearly and very truthfully that he was a man of the Victorian age. But then when Eric Blair was growing up, it was Edward VII that was king, and that would have been Queen Victoria's son. He was Edward VII, but they called that age the Edwardian age. They were very, very well dressed, and in fact, even some of the styles in England today tend to be Edwardian. I know some people in England think American men's suits, the pants are too bloomy. But yet, if you look at the British suits, they're cut very close to the leg, and so. I have a daughter living in England now, and she's encouraged me to get rid of the bloomers and to start wearing some tighter leg pants, which I have been doing since over the last couple of years, I've lost about, well, I'd say maybe 75 to 95 pounds. So I can wear those suits now and get away with it. Sheldon goes on to say about Richard, he said he was hardly the kind of person who welcomed change. So that's where I get the idea that he was probably pretty much of a bore. He was a reserved, cautious, deeply conservative man who liked to keep his life within the confines of an undemanding routine. His abilities were modest, his habits moderate, his opinions conventional. Driven by no strong ambitions or passions, he took few risks and avoided confrontations. Throughout his adult life, he maintained the carefully composed exterior of a faithful bureaucrat. His appearance was immaculate. He wore crisp, well-tailored clothes, had a sturdy build, a firm jaw, and a pair of deep-set blue eyes. His favorite pastimes were golf and bridge. In old age, he kept a reserved seat at a local cinema and dutifully sat through each new film, regardless of its quality. So essentially, what Sheldon might be saying, he was so boring that he would really sit there and endure a boring film as well. So if I can be a little comic with this. In the words of one family member, he was a superbly unadventurous man. Now, again, maybe Sheldon felt he could write that as he did because obviously Richard Blair has been dead for quite some time. But as we go through 1984 and as we go through more of these first couple lectures or first couple podcasts on Blair, we're going to see that, well, he was adventurous. He was not conventional. And he was driven by strong passions. So we'll see a big difference. Just to go on about his dad, I think it's important to show this. It says he came from a large family, the youngest of 10 children. He was born in Millbourne, St. Andrew, Dorset, where his father was the vicar. So Eric Blair's dad was the son of a minister, or he was a man in the ministry. It says in the 18th century, the Blairs had been a prosperous family with aristocratic connections. Richard's great-grandfather had married a daughter of the Earl of Westmoreland and had enjoyed the income from several lucrative properties in Jamaica. So that's probably the sugar industry that they were running in Jamaica at that time. It said, but little of this wealth had trickled down to Richard's father, who led a simple, quiet life in his country parish. He died when Richard was 10, leaving only a small income for his family's support. At 18, Richard had to make his own way in the world, and he chose to do so in the service to the empire. And so a lot of young men at that time who were, you know, educated did go into empire service. It says many imperial paths were open to him. The army was perhaps the most obvious choice. But if he had been really ambitious, he might have tried to enter the exalted ranks of the Indian Civil Service, which is limited to about 1,000 carefully selected men. These men held the top administrative posts in the various provinces of the subcontinent and were widely admired for their efficiency and integrity. But below them were the specialized services, the police, the civil engineers, the forest service, etc. It was at this second tier of the bureaucracy that young Richard found a place. With a little help from a family friend in London, he managed to secure a position in the least distinguished, most obscure branch of the specialized service, the opium department. This is where I think we could say where Eric Blair got really embarrassed about his family. Sheldon goes on to say, in one brief autobiographical note from 1947, Orwell refers to his father as an official in the English administration of India. Orwell never wrote anything more specific about the job, but it was not something that he could have described with pride. Other writers have given the impression that his father was a sort of policeman engaged in the benign supervision of the native drug trade. But the truth is that Mr. Blair spent his entire working life helping to perpetuate one of the worst evils of the British colonial system. And that was the opium trade to the poor, afflicted, opium-addicted people in China. And so you can see where that's where Blair may have been embarrassed about, you know, his father. And so we'll probably come back to some of that just a little bit later. Now I want to talk briefly about Blair's mother, because it really seems to me like, how did these two really get together. Because if he was quite unadventurous, his wife seems just the opposite. She seems really adventurous. And you could probably see where maybe Blair gets certain qualities from his dad, certainly certain qualities from his mother. This is still Sheldon in his biography talking, and he's talking about Richard Blair. Listen to this. It says, as a bachelor, he braved 20 years of his life without complaint. And then one day in 1896, when he was 39, he married an attractive young woman who was nearly half his age. So for being a boor, you know, how did he do this? How did he accomplish this? And he goes on to say her name was Ida Mabel Limousin. She had been a governess in India and had been engaged to marry another man, but was jilted and accepted Blair on the rebound. That is the most dangerous thing that could happen to anybody. If you get jilted, you know, maybe you ought to quit dating for a while until you get over it, because you could end up marrying Richard Blair. So anyway, I probably shouldn't be so comical about it, but it just seems that's what happens to people. Now, she was a slender woman with large eyes, thick wavy hair, and that's probably where Blair got his thick wavy hair. It said she had a dark, faintly slender, exotic appearance. Her family background was itself somewhat exotic. The daughter of a French father and an English mother, she was born on May 18, 1875, in the small suburb of Penge, only a few miles south of London. She grew up, however, thousands of miles away in Moulmein, a busy port in Lower Burma, where her father's family was established in the teak trade and in boat building. There was even a street named after them in the town. At the height of their prosperity, they lived well indeed. One of Ida's sisters would later boast that their father, Frank, had lived like the prince in Burma, employing at one point a staff of 30 servants. Sheldon goes on to say this may have been the case for a short period, but the fact is that he was a reckless man who wasted his fortune. It does sound like she came from a more adventurous family and a more adventurous father. Now, Ida's mother, her name was Teresa Catherine. Sheldon goes on to say that she was a stalwart Victorian lady who endured not only her husband's thriftless ways, but also the pains of bearing their 9 children and of bringing them up in arduous tropical climate. She was leading an active life in Moulmein in the early 1920s when her grandson Eric arrived in Burma as a young colonial policeman. Now, we're going to talk more about Eric Blair's jobs before he became a writer, and he was definitely a colonial policeman. Again, this biography is interesting. It was written in 1961, Orwell, the authorized biography, and it's really hard to find a copy of it. It was really kind of a fluke that I found a good hard copy of it. But if you're interested in reading more about Blair's life, you might want to pick up this biography, and you could always check ABE Books if you wanted to do that. Sheldon goes on to talk about after their wedding, and it doesn't sound like, you know, Richard Blair was very much of the head of the family, but it seems like Ida was. It says, after her wedding, Ida lived with Richard Blair in Bengal for 8 years. A proud, independent woman, she had a lively mind and was not the least intimidated by her older husband. Indeed, she wasted little time establishing herself as the dominant partner. She made a good home for Mr. Blair, but it was on her terms, and he was not one to raise objections. She always called him Dick and took a slightly condescending attitude toward him. In later years, they kept separate bedrooms, and though there was never any ill will between them, Ida always made it clear that she was in charge of the home. And he goes on to quote, says, poor old Dick, one relative called. If he was heard poking in the fire, it was Dick, put that poker down. And so, he goes on to say that Mrs. Blair was really more prepared for life in Bengal than most English wives. He goes on to say that childbirth was often fatal for British women when they're living in Bengal. But he said, Mrs. Blair was fortunate. She gave birth to 2 children in India, and there was no complications. Her first was a girl born in April 1898, and the child was named Marjorie Frances Blair. And then 5 years later, then on June 25, 1903, Ida Blair gave birth to a son at the family's bungalow in Mata Hari, and the couple named him Eric Arthur Blair. After Eric was born, she decided it was time to move back to England, and that's exactly what she did. This is what Sheldon also says. He says, less than a year after this photograph, there was a photograph of the two of them together. It says, less than a year after this photograph, Mrs. Blair took up a new post at a much larger town, Mongair, I guess, on the Ganges. It was decided, however, that the rest of the family would not resettle there. Marjorie was six, and the custom was to send English children of that age home to be educated. Sometimes the mothers remained in India with their husbands, but many chose to stay in England until their husbands retired, or at least until the youngest child had reached adolescence. So Ida preferred to be with her children in England, and then in 1904 she left India, and they returned to England. There's a few more things I wanted to talk about today, but it looks like we're running out of time for this program, and that always happens to me. So next time what we'll do is we'll talk more about Eric Blair's young years growing up in England. I think you're going to find that very fascinating. Now, remember, this is just the beginning of our summer early fall series, A Blast from the Past. The first book of this series is the famous prescient novel classic, I guess we could also call it a classic novel, 1984 by George Orwell. And this first selection has some eye-opening instruction, and it's telling us a lot of what is happening right now in government and on your nightly news. Now, you can buy 1984 at Amazon.com, but you can also find a used copy of the book at abebooks.com. And, of course, you can also check your local library. So please write me any comments you may have to jbl at pcog.org. Remember, you can follow JBL on Twitter at jbliterature1. And you can also follow JBL on Facebook. Simply search for Just the Best Literature. And I will be beefing up that Facebook page here in the next couple of weeks. So until next time, keep reading.
You've been listening to Just the Best Literature on Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG. Streaming online at kpcg.fm and thetrumpet.com.